When Paul Gilgee first called me about 6 weeks ago to ask me to do this, he laid out some very general guidelines, and some interesting things happened after that. Like one evening, I picked up the local paper in North St. Paul and found it in the headlines. I was giving a very major State of the Region speech that was going to talk about the following things, which I wrote down quick so I wouldn't make any mistakes. The next thing that happened was the Citizens League newsletter came out, and those things were more refined than ever. So in an attempt to meet, whether it be informal or formal, your requests by way of your staff, I'd like to go through what they laid out by way of what we see is here now, what our problems are, how we compare to the rest of the country as far as an urban area is concerned. I think by way of introduction, the problems that really, in all honesty, are foremost in the minds of the citizens of the Twin Cities metropolitan area are really not regional problems. They are national and international, and they relate to inflation, recession, and unemployment. I think once we understand that, then we can move to talk about the picture in the metropolitan area of the Twin Cities. And from the regional perspective only, I think it's safe to say, for the first time in several years, we are not faced with a major identifiable crisis. We have had a lull in government by crises at the regional level, and this has given us time to look to the future, time to see where we are, to put things together, and to think creatively. And I, for one, am personally grateful for that break. This is not to say we are without our share of problems. Obviously we are, and we'll get to those. But from the national perspective, our region is in excellent shape, and the future is bright. Let's look at the Twin Cities metropolitan area in 1974 and see what kind of shape we are really in. First, we are not like any other metropolitan area in the United States. The Twin Cities is the nation's 14th largest metropolitan area. It is located on the northwest edge of urbanized America, somewhat off the main stream of transportation. It is the center of a very large, low-density, predominantly rural region of the nation. We are not, and we will never be, the center of national transportation, development, or growth. And we may be better off because we're not. Of the 25 metropolitan areas in the country, the Twin Cities is fifth in median family income, $11,700 in 1969, and our estimates show it to be around $15,000 now. Under 5% of this region's families fall below the poverty level. The area is fifth overall in the educational attainment of its population. 12.4 median years of formal education for the population over 25 years of age. It is fourth in home ownership, 65% own homes, and fourth in the number of persons per household, 3.2. It is 23rd in population density, a significant figure, and showed a net migration gain between 1960 and 1970. Only 9 of the 25 major metropolitan areas reflected an increase. It has a higher percentage of professional technical employment in its workforce than the nation itself or 9 other metropolitan areas. The economy is diversified, strong in manufacture of goods, retail trade, and service. It has good automobile mobility. In fact, you can get anywhere from the metropolitan urbanized area to another on the freeway system within a half an hour in non-peak hours. Its cultural and recreational facilities are highly regarded. It is first in the number of hospital beds in the country, 14th in doctors, and 5th in the number of dentists per capita. We have a diversified economic base and an economy with well-developed commercial connections with the national economy that provides protection against local cyclical economic problems. Educational, recreational, and cultural opportunities are abundant, and the area to date has managed to avoid, or at least minimize, the very severe problems of crime, physical decay, and social unrest that have plagued almost every other metropolitan area in the country. This is how we look in relation to the other major urban centers of the nation. The picture is largely a positive one, and the recent quality of life surveys that have been made throughout the country support and publicize this conclusion. But a better proof, perhaps, than the surveys are the steady stream of journalists and government officials from all over the United States who come here curious to find the answers to how our region has been able to find, metropolitanize, and still keep and improve its quality of life. I believe an excellent answer to these questions lies within the community itself. We have an independent but interdependent business, labor, and governmental community. Perhaps most uniquely and fourth, an element in this whole picture is the active involvement of our various citizens groups, including obviously the Citizens League. The interaction of these four groups has made it possible to develop and implement programs responsible for a great deal of progress. An excellent example of this cooperation or shared responsibility recently is the proposed critical areas designation, the chance to preserve, protect, and improve the use of one of our most magnificent resources, the Mississippi River. Another excellent answer lies with our ability to place ourselves in focus as a total metropolitan area, to look ahead, plan for the future, and to identify what needs to be done to preserve and improve the quality of life we prize so highly here. After all that, we still cannot become complacent. We have our share of problems, many of them extremely complex and interrelated, and there are very few easy solutions. I would like to go over with you briefly some of them. First and foremost is housing. Housing costs in this area are extremely high compared to the rest of the nation. The average cost of a home is in the top 20% of major metropolitan areas, and we live in the 13th most expensive urban area in which to rent. In 1972, there were 29,700 housing permits issued. This figure is admittedly high due to a large number of permits taken out late in 1972 to avoid paying the sewer service availability charge, which went into effect in January of 1973. In 1973, there were 13,350 permits issued. This year's figures will likely be lower even than that. Just to meet the needs of new families being formed and new housing demanded, we will need to build 380,000 units by 1990, in addition to preserving the existing housing supply. To avoid a serious housing shortage by the early 1980s, we need to construct over 23,000 new units per year. In other words, about 10,000 more than were constructed last year. Very clearly, we are continuing to slip behind in the area of housing. Government programs for low and moderate income housing last year built only 917 new units in the metropolitan area. This is down 50% from 1972 and less than one-tenth of the actual need. Saddest of all, last year there was no public housing built at all. In terms of location, and this is not particularly significant because of the low numbers, in 73 and 74, 48% of the subsidized units were built in the suburban areas as compared to 36% the year before. Second, employment and the economy. Our regional unemployment rate is up, but below the national average. In 1973, our rate was 3.5, compared to 4.7 for the state and 4.9 for the nation. Our figure for August of this year was 3.9, whereas nationally it was 5.3. September stayed the same here, 3.9. Nationally, 5.8. In October, we jumped to 4.6, while the nation went to 6.0. We are fortunate our employment is not tied to any one sector of the economy. 16.7% of our workforce is in retail trade. Other large employers by type are the following: durable good production, 25%, non-durable goods, 10%, government and education comprise 10%. By types of occupation, 20% of the workforce is clerical, 17% professional technical, 13% operatives, whatever that means. Twelve percent are craftsmen, and 12% involved in the service. Farmers and farm workers comprise 0.1% of our region's workforce, 21,600 people to be exact. It is also interesting to note that in 1970, 3% of the workforce commuted from outside our area to work here. Also in 1969, one half of the farmers supplemented their farm income with other employment. That figure grew from 39% in 1964. The Metropolitan Council began work on an input-output model of the economy that should yield valuable information about the region. The idea is to develop a gross area product similar to the gross national product. It would deal with the interrelationship of economic activity in the area. The model shows, at this point, a gross area product in 1971, the last available figures, of $11 billion, of which approximately $1.8 was real estate rental, $1.7 billion new construction, $1.5 billion retail trade, $1.4 billion wholesale sales and trade, $1.1 billion government, and $1.0 billion finance and insurance. This needs a great deal more work on our part, as well as more evaluation and criticism, but I mention it so that you will be aware of the possibilities of its development. Economic work at the Metropolitan Council has also included projecting the employment categories out to 1980. The projections indicate that, like the rest of the country, the region will be moving towards a more service-oriented economy. In addition, the projection calls for a 94% increase in the number of workers in the professional technical ranks. The wholesale and retail categories are expected to drop from first to third, while manufacturing and services moves up to first and second. A decline in construction employment is projected. A 55% drop in the number of farmers and farm workers is also forecast. Overall, a 26% increase in employment is predicted by 1980, bringing the region's total to over 1 million persons in the workforce. Projections out to 1990 show a redistribution of employment, with the central city share dropping from 56 to 41%. In the area of water pollution control, substantial progress has been made in this area. Dissolved oxygen content in river water is now up to standard on all reaches of the rivers in the region except below Pig's Eye. Of the 22 sewer board treatment plants, 14 now consistently meet all standards at all times. Four come close, and four do not. And these four will be phased out in the near future. Two more treatment plants have been closed down on Lake Minnetonka, resulting in a 75% reduction in the amount of effluent going into the lake since that program began. And the Rosemont plant, an experimental physical chemical treatment process, shows a great deal of promise. In air quality, our air quality meets air maintenance levels set by the federal government. With our downtown areas, we are required to be within ambient air standards by May 31st of next year. We will meet that. The monitoring taking place indicates our air pollution is lessening in the downtown areas due to traffic control procedures and better equipped autos. On the industrial side, the number of sulfur dioxide violations have dropped off markedly, and permits from the state are now required. However, odor pollution, particularly in and around downtown St. Paul, continues to be a problem, particularly during unfavorable climatic conditions. Unfortunately, there is still no plan to deal with it on a comprehensive basis that would take into account all the industrial activities causing the odors, that must become a high priority for us. Disposal of our solid wastes. We are presently halfway through our 10-year plan for disposing of solid waste in sanitary landfills. When I was a kid, they were called dumps, but they're sanitary landfills. There is no concrete program for what to do in the long range. Recycling studies are being conducted that involve the Pig's Eye plant, the Cedar Riverside development, and the Metro Recycling Center. Homeowners' costs for solid waste disposal are still relatively low because most of our disposal sites are located close enough to require only short hauling distances. However, finding environmentally safe sites continues to be a problem, particularly in Ramsey and in Washington County. In Parks and Open Space, a $40 million regional bonding program for parks passed by the last session of the legislature has helped preserve for public use a number of threatened park facilities throughout the region. Other legislative mechanisms, such as the Critical Areas Act and environmental impact statements, provide good tools, albeit slow, to see that environmental issues are considered in development decisions. But an evaluation of the environmental impact statement from a procedural point of view ought to be undertaken, perhaps streamlining the procedures so that it can be used for its intended purpose and not simply as a delaying strategy. Legislation passed in 1974 required the Metropolitan Council to prepare guidelines for protection of open spaces in the region. Those are close to being finalized and will be in the very near future. Public transportation, what I would consider personally the second major crisis that we face. We continue to be an auto-oriented region. The reason is obvious. Our highway system gives us excellent mobility, particularly in comparison with other areas of the country. Our bus service system continues to improve. Since we entered public ownership, bus route service has nearly doubled in mileage. Ridership is up about 8% in fiscal 1974. Bus riders now have an 80% chance of stepping aboard a new bus, whether there's a car painted on the side or not. Our energy problems have helped to improve ridership, but the public has not taken the energy crisis seriously in this region. Given this region's geographic location, at or close to the end of the oil supply line, couple this with a dwindling fuel supply and the public's ever-increasing demand for fuel, the result is obvious, a major problem of critical proportions. This comes at a time when the question of major public investment in mass transit is being seriously debated in Washington. That decision will be neither easy nor cheap. The cost of the Washington, D.C. metro system, the new subway system, recently jumped from $3 billion to over $4.5 billion. The decision will be particularly hard for public officials because I suspect there is very little outpouring of support for public money for public transportation and won't be until our cars are running out of gas or it is financially impossible for most of us to operate one. But that decision must be made, and it must be made soon. As a region, we cannot afford any more delay. Agriculture. Perhaps most significantly, urban planners are beginning to finally recognize agriculture as an important urban activity. From 1964 to 73, we experienced a 25% decline in the number of farms in our seven-county region. There was a 16% decline in the amount of land in farms, and a 28% decline in the number of persons living on farms. The trend is clear, and that is consolidation of farm holdings along with the conversion of farmland to non-farm uses. It's also interesting that 83% of the farming activity is in dairy products, livestock, poultry, and horticulture compared to 64% in the rest of the state. This indicates to us farmers are growing products to be sold in the urban area and are not farming major crops. Most of these physical problems are obvious. Less obvious, but just as real, are the social implications. We have a number of what I consider to be very disturbing social trends. While we had a 22% increase in population from 1962 to 72, serious crime increased by 155%. Our data also shows that serious crime is increasing at a faster rate in the suburbs than in the central cities. There is a continuing trend toward geographic separation of income groups. There is a continuing trend toward concentration of racial minorities in the older, poorer sections of the central cities. There is a trend towards an unbalanced age structure in older neighborhoods, with the same phenomenon beginning to occur in close-in, first-ring suburbs. Significant amount of our housing stock is growing old and needs replacement. A great many of the problems that I've outlined, both physical and social, are intermeshed with the whole question of the growth of the region. I was told not to get into a great deal of detail because that wasn't the purpose, but I'm going to get in a little bit of it anyway. Well, I don't want to imply that the guided growth plan for the region, what we call the development framework, as it has evolved to date, will solve all our problems. I do, however, suggest the following. First, I believe it will, for the first time, set some parameters around which other kinds of decisions can be made, decisions which before the framework had to be based on less than adequate information. Secondly, I believe the framework as a starting point, a guide to enable us to more objectively evaluate the region in the years ahead. Where should we focus our efforts in the mid-70s? I suggest to you that we must focus these efforts on the implementation of the programs of the development framework or guided growth. It should become the priority of business, labor, government, and the citizen community. Its programs will not succeed without such effort. The very foundation of the development framework is based on such an attitude. Again, I want to emphasize that the framework is not a static document. It is a continuing, evolving, dynamic process to create the forum and focal point to identify, thoughtfully consider, debate, and eventually make the necessary decisions for our future. We in government cannot do this alone. Let me cite an example. The Metropolitan Council is proposing that our governmental units should jointly develop long-range plans to preserve, maintain, and revitalize our older areas. We will be proposing municipal development corporations and other government mechanisms to meet that need. But governmental efforts such as that will not be sufficient to carry out the preservation to meet the needs of our housing supply. Private industry and the financial community will have to help. We must find ways to expedite and standardize the government review process. A great deal of work needs to be done on the effects of codes and ordinances on the cost of housing, and we are suggesting to the legislature that that study be undertaken. What can we in government do to make it good business to invest in the mature areas of this region? Is the financial community willing to make the guided growth policies a significant factor in future investment decisions? Finally, I'd like to anticipate at least one question. Is the development framework or the guided growth plan going to work? Are we really going to be able to preserve the quality of life that we value so highly? When reporters from the Washington Post, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and more recently the National Geographic asked that question, my answer was simple. I believe it's going to work because this area has a tradition of excellence. A tradition of cooperation and shared responsibilities. And those traditions may well be our most valuable asset. Thank you. Do you want me to feel